Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud returned from a nice little trip to Italy. Excited to have you back. Excited to hear a little bit about your trip in general. Good to just get a chance to catch up and turn in one of these Nolcasts that we're so fond of. And as we talk about that, want to thank our friends from Louisiana Hot Sauce. Just three ingredients, but pretty fantastic flavor. For over 90 years now, Louisiana has been bringing a fantastic value as far as the cost per application. I put it on all types of food. I use it as a marinade. I incorporate it damn near into every meal that I fix.
Exactly, man. It's just simple and good. Like, there's so much stuff you can put it on. It's kind of my default go-to, like, man, this meal I made is not that good. How can I make it better? And I grab a bottle of Louisiana hot sauce and put some on there. Fat-free, carb-free, pretty healthy.
Bud, great to have you back, man. And congratulations on what sounds like a fantastic trip.
Grazie.
Yeah, grazie. I see that. I see you've brought back some of the native tongue with you.
I was actually so tan from camp season that a lot of the vendors that approached me started hitting me with Spanish, which I speak okay. And my wife was like, I think they think you're a Spaniard, which was kind of funny. And she was pretty tan too, because it's been nice and sunny down here. So that was interesting. Italy was a blast, man. I actually have a funny story to share. I guess we can open this up. I think I'll share this for our sponsorship segment, okay, by the way.
All right.
Because I know Township has something that might kind of prompt this. And Township is part of our other sponsor, the For the Table Restaurant Group with Madison Social, as well as Central and Township, the beer garden there. For our second sponsor read later on in the show, we'll talk about my funny story. But Italy was great, man. I listened to the episode you did. I'm glad we could get another one out for listeners, and that was really good. Had a little bit of feedback about our ESPN show, and one thing I wanted to address, and this may be on us for not making this point clear enough, but look, I'm pretty conservative. Some of the stuff on ESPN I don't like, but there's a big difference between not liking some of ESPN's liberal slant, which certainly exists, and canceling your cable TV subscription, which is not happening due to politics. And the real easy question here to figure this out is, do you watch Fox News? Because if you say yes to that, and I think most of the people who are saying, hey, I canceled ESPN because of their conservative slant or their liberal slant, have probably also retweeted or shared something on Facebook from Fox News recently. And they are probably also watching Fox News, which they may not be watching ESPN as much, but they are certainly still subscribing to cable. And thus, if you're still subscribing to cable, you're also subscribing to ESPN. So thinking ESPN is a liberal slant, I agree. Not like unsubscribing from cable because of that, not buying it. And I don't think anybody else at ESPN or in the TV analytics industry is either.
It's a common complaint, and there's certainly some very legitimate points tied to it. I will tell you that when ESPN does things like name Caitlyn Jenner, athlete of the year, person of the year, whatever that was, that seems a little forced. That seems a little manufactured. I think that's an easy, let me see, bud. I think that's an easy comment to throw in at the end of a conversation like, yeah, ESPN slanted too far to the left. And like I said, there's some legitimacy to that. But I don't know that that's necessarily the main reason why, Joe Smith goes and cancel his subscription to cable overall. So I know we got a lot of feedback in general from that episode, and it's a conversation that's, seems like there's a new wrinkle every day in the news, depending on where you look. And there's a whole lot of moving pieces in that market in general. So long-winded way of saying that this is not the last time that we'll touch on that. But just good to circle back and respond to some of the feedback that we had from that episode, and it was pretty significant in general. Not so much argumentative or anything, and some of the actual follow-up that I've had from that episode as far as people sharing links and stories and anecdotes that they heard elsewhere has been particularly nice, and it's obviously something that that people are pretty engaged in, and it's a transformative period of time that we're going through, not only with TV but with media in general. So interesting to follow, and interesting to be a bystander too.
Did you see the Sports Illustrated news last night?
Which are you referring to?
They laid off their top college basketball guy, which comes in the wake of ESPN just gutting their college basketball staff. I mean, the major layoffs at ESPN were hockey, right? And that makes sense. ESPN, hockey doesn't do good ratings, and ESPN does not have hockey rights. So why pay people to talk about a sport that you don't have rights to broadcast? I get it. But the second biggest layoff group at ESPN was actually college basketball. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, is the one-and-done rule really hurting the popularity of college basketball because of the inability to build year after year stars and compelling stories? I think there's a very real issue there.
Hell yeah, there is. I mean, college basketball has reduced itself, has simmered down its product to a condensed, 3.5 week period of interest for the majority of the college athletic follower. It's just it's cannibalized its own regular season, which, let that be a lesson to other college sports, hint hint. And it has, you know, obviously the brackets are a social phenomenon, and how many people will fill one out that don't watch college basketball in those first 48 hours, those first 96 hours of the tournament are fantastic. And I think it's one of the two or three lowest production days as far as the U.S. economy, because people just sit there and watch that on their computer or find a reason to have a long lunch or anything else. But the sport itself has become just absent of people's interest for a vast majority of the season. So it doesn't surprise me per se that ESPN went through and thinned out its college basketball unit pretty significantly.
Yeah, I think we'll see layoffs at other companies too. We've already seen Bleacher just gut their staff and appear to focus on things that they have the rights to broadcast. And by they, I mean Turner, which bought Bleacher in large part. I don't know, man. I don't want this show to become part two. We're just following up on some things that we discussed before I went on vacation. We do have a lot of FSU stuff to talk about this week, though.
Got a lot of content, in general to go over. So excited about the show that we will have to put forward. And Bud, why don't we just go ahead and jump into new content, and that is been a pretty interesting redshirt proposal that caught both of our eyes that I know we want to at least briefly introduce here and give a little bit of a back and forth as to what the ramifications might be if something like that goes through.
Indeed. Reading from a Stuart Mandel article here real quick. The American Football Coach Association is forwarding a proposal to the NCAA that would allow players to participate in up to 4 games of a season without burning their redshirt year. If passed, theoretically, a coach could unleash his touted 4-star freshman running back in the Tax Slayer Bowl. I think that would be pretty intriguing to some fan bases, said AFCA Executive Director Todd Berry, which might legitimize some of those bowl games and make them more interesting. Following the AFCA's board meetings last week in Phoenix, Berry said that while McCaffrey and Fournette made headlines, you know, by skipping the bowl games, obviously, players shutting it down before a lower-tier bowl game is, quote, not a new thing. While those particular stars dealt with legitimate health issues last season, others in the past might develop a, quote, magic injury right before the bowl. So I think this is multi-layered. Clearly, coaches and college football are worried about stars skipping out on bowl games, which certainly their TV partners are not happy with. You could see easily, hey, Leonard Fournette in the promo for the Music City Bowl, and then all of a sudden, nope, he's not playing. Oh, it did not hurt them in the draft. Obviously, both of them went, you know, kind of almost a round earlier than Dalvin did. Do you like this idea?
A couple of initial reactions upon looking at it, bud. I like it in the sense that, like, anytime you make your more of your roster available to play, anytime you get a chance to see more kids, that's exciting. There's a small... I mean, that's very much what happens at some of these smaller bowl games. People go ahead and transition their focus to next year. They go ahead and transition their focus to getting certain segments of their team ready and to take a chance or to take a look at kids that they haven't otherwise had a chance to look at. I'm a little skeptical, I guess, in the fact that it almost lets you, like, get more use out of your kids in a cynical way. I'm not doing a great job of verbalizing that, but, like, it just lets you get more out of your scholarship athlete than maybe you would otherwise, which is a good thing. I'm curious as to exactly how that'll be implemented and what that'll look like, but some pretty significant ramifications from it, undoubtedly.
Yeah, I'm going to say I like it. Now, Jimbo Fisher has long proposed just give the kids 5 years to play and don't work and just eliminate redshirt stuff, right? You know, that is, I think, the best idea. But here, I think there's a potentially significant motivational element here, right? To where I can sometimes coaches, and I've talked to coaches about this, they acknowledge a kid needs to redshirt for maturity reasons or physical growth reasons or whatever, but they worry about putting a red shirt on a kid. Will he check out motivationally and, you know, mentally? We've seen that, I think, before at Florida State. And it's a tough and coach's battle here. If you offer the opportunity to play the final four games, that's a significant carrot to wave in front of a player. Right. And I don't like using the carrot and stick, you know, metaphor here, but I think it's apt. You know, that's a pretty significant reward. You could say, hey, if you bust your ass and really work hard and go to class and do the things that you're required to do, you might get to play this year. You're going to be one of the kids we call an initial red shirt, but, you know, hey, man, last four games of the year, maybe the bowl game, if you prove you're worth it, we're going to play you. Now, you might say, hey, that's different than you should already be playing kids if they prove they're worth it. And fine, I agree. But the difference is currently, if you play them in the last four games, they would lose their opportunity to redshirt. Here, they would not. You know, it would still count as a redshirt season. So I think that's pretty cool. I tried to think back on some notable examples of times that FSU could have used this, and I think there's one that really stands out in my mind, and it's 2012. The decision to redshirt Jameis, I think, was multifaceted, but the last four games of the year, maybe he would have been ready to play. I don't know. I would sure have liked to have seen him against Florida as opposed to five turnover EJ Manuel.
Yeah, that was EJ Manuel's lowest point, certainly an unfortunate way for him to turn in one of his final performances and be remembered. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of interesting ramifications as to what this would mean or could mean. I think it's a good thing in general. I do. I also think it's good. It's a good way to keep the fan base a lot more involved, motivated, and following. I mean, if you're a team that's going to the Music City Bowl and you're from a program the likes of LSU, Alabama, Florida State, Clemson, etc., one of the programs that have done particularly well over the past 10 years, and it can be hard to really find something to interest you and a real reason to watch your bowl game if it means that maybe you get a chance to take a look at that highly touted quarterback who you haven't otherwise seen, if it means that maybe you get to introduce a wide receiver that you haven't otherwise been able to show. It certainly has an interest that would be there that might not otherwise be there from the fan base if it's just this same lot that has otherwise turned in an 8-4 year. So very curious. It has a feel almost of a baseball expansion from expanding the rosters from 25 to 40. I mean, all of a sudden you can bring up all these kids from AAA that maybe you've had in your farm team, and you get to run out the last 6 or 7 weeks of the season. So it's just something that we'll look at, but it does have a nice chance to transform kind of the end of the season and particularly the bowl season. And maybe it's a way to keep people's interest in some of these bowl games that have otherwise become, in the bowl games, you could argue, have always been pretty meaningless. But bowl games now, if you're not in one of the big New Year's Day Six games, maybe even a harder challenge for some in the fan base to watch, and this might help with that some.
Oh, there's no doubt. I disagree with the argument that on the large scale, people are going to be super jacked to see these freshmen, right? Basically because I don't think most people follow like freshmen in recruiting all that much. But I do think that people watch bowl games for a couple reasons. Number one, it's football to watch in the middle of the holiday season. Number two, kind of like the last chance to see some of their favorite players, which if that decreases, it places further important on number three, which is the ability to, like you said, to treat the bowl game as a bit of a preview for next year. And I do think that playing the freshmen who are assumedly going to be playing in the following season offers you that opportunity.
Next thing I know we wanted to touch on was potentially to have a little bit of a media conversation regarding of other entities getting involved, college rights, Amazon, Twitter, Facebook. Where perhaps do you see this going, bud?
You know, I thought about it, and I think this relates a lot to the idea that we are in a college sports rights bubble. If ESPN is the top dog payer, and it's clear that they're maybe not going to be able to afford some of these outrageous rights fees they've agreed to, or won't be able to continue to negotiate new rights deals at the current levels or with anticipated inflation in the coming years, then that does represent a significant chance to pop the college sports bubble, or to burst the bubble, I think is probably the more apt term. But if you have some of these giants like Amazon, Twitter, Facebook come in and acquire broadcasting rights, well, then I think the bubble can stay inflated. That's a different revenue stream, a different player that enters the market, and potentially could be a good thing. I mean, you want to talk about who could best deliver content to people via, you know, internet streaming. Mm-hmm. Facebook does a pretty damn good job of getting internet streaming going right now, especially with the whole Facebook Live thing. And Amazon, you know, is wildly popular. Twitter, a lot less popular, but there are a lot of sports fans on Twitter. I think that that's just an interesting note we saw that I wanted to include here. It might be something we hit on later, but that's something to keep an eye on. If you guys liked our conversation 3 weeks ago about the changing sports media climate, following what Amazon and Facebook and Twitter do in these negotiations, I think could be worth it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so what I was going to say is if you want to take a look at those three, I will just throw in from a long-term perspective, if it's a I'm not saying this is going to happen in the next 3 weeks or anything, but if you look at the media landscape, maybe one of the ultimate ways that some of this gets resolved is it wouldn't shock me to. So if you tell people to take a look at Amazon, Twitter, Facebook, I'll tell people to have Apple in the back of their mind. And that is, it's not a ridiculous idea to think that Apple could view Disney as a acquisition target. And damn if that wouldn't be very much kind of the game changer that people think may be coming down the road. So you would have Apple with all its distribution capability and potential, and then all of a sudden you would give them just about all the content that they could ever think of or need, particularly when it comes from a sports angle. So just something to keep in mind, not saying that's imminent or on the horizon. But if you look at those two entities, they could potentially pair pretty well, and that may be something that maybe something that we hear about a couple years in the future.
Oh, no doubt, man. Next thing I think we wanted to discuss that we didn't get to before I left for vacation, Nick Saban, $10 million contract extension per year. That's quite the number there.
Doesn't suck at all. I mentioned Saban's contract extension very briefly in the solo pod that I did, really more as a segue into the overall kind of resource and arms race that exists in college football currently. But yeah, no, doesn't suck at all. I used it as a just another example or reminder that Alabama is not going to stop being Alabama, and that we're nowhere near slowing down the money that's going to assistant coaches or head coaches.
Yeah, it's you want to talk about bubble. It does make you wonder, like, will a college coach? And I know people thought this. God, will anybody ever make more than $1 million when Spurrier got that? Do you think we'll ever see a head coach actually hit $10 million average annual value?
Certainly, at some point we will. When that happens, I'm curious. You get the feeling that if it's not announced in the next 12 months or so, that it could be quite a long period of time. Yeah, we'll see it. It's just, I wonder if it's one of the current crop or if it's not one of these other programs that has to try to make a splash higher and maybe has some new financial support behind it that's willing to just completely, completely kind of reset the boundaries of the market.
Yeah, you want to talk about tying this into bubble. Very related. I don't think you're going to see the continuing escalation of coaching contracts in college football, even though I think ESPN is still very dedicated to college football compared to some other sports. But if ESPN is still the only true heavyweight bidding on these games, I don't think you're going to see that. But, you know, if you get some other players like Amazon, Twitter, Facebook, then I could definitely see it. We should probably hit a little sponsorship thing now.
We should, man. Always excited to point out our friends at the For the Table Restaurant Group. Most of the time, that's us talking about Madison Social, but always want to remind people, yes, Madison Social is incredible and was the first kind of part of that group that we paired with, but they also have a fantastic Italian concept of Centrale there, and then maybe today we're going to talk more about Township than anything else.
I like Township, man. It's a cool, like, beer garden, beer hall concept. They have a retractable roof, which is great because in Tallahassee it gets hot in the summer. But some days you also pop one of those occasional, you know, nice days where you're like, man, it's actually nice enough to sit outside today. Maybe the humidity's strangely dropped. I know I was at a football practice yesterday and the thermometer said 92, but the humidity level was really low. And I was like, this kind of feels like Cali a little bit. You know, like you sweat and it's evaporating off you immediately. It's kind of nice to sit outside with a little breeze. Township offers that opportunity. They also offer really good beer, a large selection of craft brews. It's a cool beer hall type concept. They actually have, check this out, and this is hard to describe on radio. The picture on their Township TLH Instagram page, which you should definitely go check out, looks a lot better. But their description, the love child between a Cuban sandwich and hot dog will be available next week. We have wrapped a hot dog with ham, topped it with mojo pork, Swiss cheese, chopped pickles, and mustard. This is not a drill, folks. It starts Monday. And judging by the number of likes it got, it looks a lot better than maybe even the description sounds. But that it is pretty cool. Pairing that with a nice craft beer, I could definitely get that. Of course, they also have free beer certain times of the week. If you check out their Instagram or Twitter pages, you can find that. They do some cool things with Proof Brewing, which I know a lot of folks in Tallahassee also like, a local brewery. Ingram, I have a cool little story to tell about a Cuban sandwich, you know, prompted by my remembering here, from Italy. We were at a little trattoria type place and getting some wine and a couple little couple little sandwich type things. And the guy had a sandwich there, and it had ham, prosciutto, Swiss cheese, pork, pickle, sun-dried tomato on a panini style pressed bun. And the guy, but it was a circle bun. And the guy told me that it was a mix sandwich, that he basically had gone to McDonald's, and his English wasn't great, but it was decent enough. And he wanted to make a round sandwich inspired by McDonald's. And I had to tell this guy.
A mix sandwich, MC sandwich. I thought you were saying M-I-X.
No, interesting. No.
Yeah.
And I basically told him, it had mustard on it too. And I was like, do I tell this guy that he has just invented the Cuban sandwich several hundred years too late? So I was like, hey, do you know Cuba? And he was like, the island? I was like, yeah. I was like, this is a Cuban sandwich. Like, this is what they are known for. He's like, really? And so he pulled out his phone and he Googled it. And he said something in Italian, which I think is probably like, well, damn. I don't know what it could have been. It could have just been like stupid American. But yeah, a guy at an Italian deli did reinvent the Cuban sandwich. But he added sun-dried tomato, which actually worked really well.
Okay.
A little additional acidity, a little sweetness.
Nice. Man, I can only imagine the food that you were introduced to during your time there.
It was great. We got to eat at two Michelin-starred places. Had probably the best pasta I've ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Walked 61,000 steps. So that's a lot of steps.
A lot of steps. Helps with the pasta, definitely.
Oh, for sure.
Non-sedentary lifestyle is a nice thing to have if you're going to be enjoying the pasta that Italy has to offer. So those two work pretty well together. Bud, a decent amount of recruiting news has transpired since the last time we talked. I don't know that we'll spend a ton of time on any of these subjects in particular, but I guess in kind of a rapid-fire style, let's just touch on a couple things. First of all, as a kid that we discussed, I think multiple times here, quarterback prospect Joe Milton committing to Michigan. Give us your thoughts on that development real quickly.
So I got asked about this a lot, despite putting a notification on my Twitter that I'm going to be off Twitter for 2 weeks while I was in Italy. And my basic response here is that I agree with FSU's decision not to offer Milton at this time. They've not had him in camp this year. Obviously, camp has not happened yet, summer camp. They already have a quarterback on the roster who has a huge arm and major accuracy problems. His name is DeAndre Francois. They also have a guy who has...
And his name is potentially James Blackman as well.
Right, who I think is more accurate than Francois was coming out of high school, and the arm... maybe not. Well, I think Blackman has a longer delivery, so it's not quite that quick snap that Francois has. Look, I've seen Milton play a bunch. I made a highlight tape of Milton that's, I think, up to 200,000 views on Facebook. I think Milton is a very strong talent at the top of his game. He also has significant downside in that he struggles in some things that concern me. Right. Accuracy being one, processing defense speed being two. I don't think he's a guy who is going to start early in his career. If you're Michigan, you've done a very good job recruiting the quarterback position in the last 2 years, having landed Brandon Peters, who I really liked out of Indianapolis. And then last year, Dylan McCaffrey, who, I didn't love, but he's good. That is the younger brother of Christian out of Denver. And you also have Wilton Spate this year, who I think is graduating, so he's not really entering into this equation. You can afford to take a chance on Joe Milton, I think, if you're Michigan. I've watched Joe Milton up close. I think he makes a great throw, and then he, for a touchdown, and then on a two-point conversion, he's got a wide-open crossing route guy, and he rockets the ball for no reason when he could have just floated it to him. And it goes off the kid's back shoulder, spikes up into the air, and is intercepted. there's a lot of work to be done. And I like Joe. I think he's a nice kid. I think he's misguided with this idea that he's not a dual threat quarterback. If you judge him just on his passing ability, I would decrease his ranking. He is a strong runner. I don't think he's like a Michael Vick runner, but he's tough to bring down. The guy is like 6'6", 240 probably. He's very big. Maybe 230. He's a big kid. So I agree with the decision not to offer at this time. Maybe if he comes to your summer camp and you work with him and you're able to, and he picks up things quickly, maybe you reconsider. But at this point, I don't think FSU needed to offer him. Right now, their focus is Jaren Williams, who decommitted from Kentucky, had a nice junior year. FSU liked him last year some, obviously wanted to see him in summer camp, wanted to continue to evaluate him before giving him like a committable offer type offer. And then he's out of Georgia. And then also Justin Fields, the Penn State commit out of Georgia, who continues to take visits elsewhere. Ingram, that is always an interesting sign, as well as Emory Jones, the Ohio State commit out of Georgia. It really is a special year for quarterbacks in Georgia this season. It's Fields and Williams. I expect them both to come to summer camp. And right now, if I had to pick who's going to be FSU's quarterback, I would definitely say it'll be most likely one of those two. But I'm not particularly worried about it at this point. I don't think that FSU has made like serious missteps with its quarterback recruiting this year. The quarterbacks in the state are not great.
Not great, and you just got to do the best with what's out there. Certainly, Justin Fields is, in my opinion, I don't know if he's their number one prospect. I would rate that as the most likely candidate in the class. That's a situation, obviously, where you're fighting Penn State, the school he's currently committed to, and maybe Florida's gotten a little bit more involved in that equation than we had previously talked about as well. But Florida State obviously has their attention, has positioned themselves really well, and wouldn't shock me at all to ultimately see Florida State win that kid's signature. Florida State potentially battling in Ohio State for a quarterback. Florida State is most definitely battling Ohio State linebacker, 2018 kid out of Virginia.
Yeah, Taraja Mitchell. Man, this kid is a true throwback middle linebacker. I think the good comparison for him would be a more talented Buster Davis. All right, loves to hit, very active, aggressive, downhill thumper. I talked to him at the Future 50 event in Orlando in December, right after Christmas. Yeah, because it's before the Under Armour game. And we shoot these profile videos on these kids, and we later put their highlights with it. And I was like, hey, describe your game. And I think what I got to pull up the tape, but I think what he said was, hit man. I'm a hitter. I just love hitting people. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of what you want out of your middle linebacker. I mean, you obviously want more than that, but that's an important foundation. He has college-ready size, moves pretty well with it, and I'm telling you, man, he's a heck of a player. Visiting FSU this weekend, probably will be on campus by the time you listen to this, and his final two is Ohio State and Florida State. It wouldn't shock me if he's committed this weekend, but I'm not really expecting it. You know what I'm saying? Like, sometimes kids get caught up in the moment, but as far as I know, he doesn't have any plans to announce a commitment immediately. Mm-hmm. That'd be a hell of a get, though, after you lost to Ron Vincent to Ohio State.
Hell of a get. Maybe a situation where 6 months ago this looked like a kid that ultimately would end up going to Florida State. At this point, it's very much Ohio State, Florida State, in my opinion. Ohio State may even hold a little bit of a lead, but this very much appears to be his final visit. And like you referenced, not a kid that's going to necessarily make his decision while he's on that visit, but a guy whose recruiting process appears to be coming to a close here fairly soon, and looks like he'll have a decision one way or another in the next couple of weeks.
Indeed. Do you know where Florida State is in the rankings right now?
And on the 2018 class, I don't know immediately.
Yes. Yeah. Let's pull it up here. They are seventh. Clemson is sixth. Miami is first by a good margin, but Miami has 17 commits already. Florida State has 8. So Florida State's average rating is exactly tied with Miami. If you care about that kind of stuff, Clemson's rating is going to be extremely high this year on an average player basis. Probably will not have a true shot at the number one class just because of their size limitations. I have an article coming out about that on SB Nation, which you guys can check out, and I'll be sure to share it on Tomahawk Nation. Should be pretty cool. Now, here's something I really want to drive home. Ingram, do you want to take a guess where Alabama is right now? The school that has signed the number one class in the last 7 years and is showing like no signs of drop-off?
This is just a guess. 9th?
A little lower.
Lower is, okay. 7th? Or no, you just said 7th. 6.
Excuse me.
A little higher?
Higher. Higher number.
13th in the country?
Higher.
Damn. 19th?
Higher.
Wow. Well, they obviously have yet to apply their local pressure there, but are they in the top 25 currently?
They are not.
Wow. Wow. Okay. That's interesting.
They are, but they are, I will say this, they are solidly 12 spots ahead of Vanderbilt, who is at 58. So Alabama is 46th
nestled in the right country. There in the top 50. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. Next to Iowa, North Carolina, Northern Illinois, Colorado, Wake Forest, Syracuse, East Carolina. Yeah. Look, this is, and Georgia is 63rd.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I'm saying is these early team rankings, they really don't mean much, guys. That it's not a big deal. We're still evaluating these players. If I'm going to speak very honestly on the subject, and I think I can because I don't put rankings on kids, early rankings are really faulty. They exist primarily to sell subscriptions so that 247, Scout, ESPN, Rivals, whomever can tell you, hey, this kid just committed and he is a blank star. If he just committed and he doesn't have a star on him at all, people are like, well, what star is he? Right? And justifiably so. They want to know. It's a common currency of ranking. But it's not to be trusted early on. And I do classify this still as early on. In fact, I was talking to a college coach last year. Well, not last year. Last week. And he told me, he said, I think the biggest inefficiency in rankings is their lack of emphasis placed on the senior year of a prospect because they are so focused with getting the next year's rankings out that they ignore the most recent data point that is the senior season. And I think he's totally right about that.
Hmm.
How I, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. It's like, huh, that makes sense because kids are still growing, especially kids who are not quote unquote overaged, who haven't been held back. Early on, what I like to do is pay attention essentially only to the rankings of the blue chips, because I feel like there's a lot of fluidity and market corrections that go on with your 2- and 3-star or unranked players early on in the cycle, right? And as the season goes on, rankings agencies are much more apt to increase a player's ranking than decrease it. As such, they are reluctant early on to slap 5- and 4-star ratings on kids because then they don't want to face the backlash of later dropping a kid's ranking, especially if it has to be dropped severely. So in my opinion, if a kid is a strong 4- or 5-star ranking almost at any point, he's probably more than likely, I think, a really good player, especially if he's got one of those early 4- or 5-star rankings. What I don't trust is the inverse. Just because the kid is ranked 2 or 3 stars early on, oftentimes that means, hey, we haven't really fully evaluated him. We're just putting a ranking on him to be able to like have some kind of star next to his name. So I don't really trust some of the early 2- and 3-star rankings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's a good perspective from somebody that's in the business, and I think it very much makes sense. And hey, look, it's just easier to evaluate the 15, 20, 25 kids that stand out and you can look at as a sophomore and be like, yeah, that kid's going to be a major, major prospect. He's already got Alabama, you know, offers from Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, et cetera. I understand what you're saying. And I think there's a real pool of players that that people are familiar with, whether it's because of the program they've gone to, whether it's because they've had a teammate in the two previous classes that was a major national recruit, and people have come by and seen him in a practice setting. It's easier to have a real idea as to these top flight prospects when, I agree, a lot of times other kids may fly under the radar. And it's I very much agree with your part about if a kid gets a high 4-star or 5-star slapped on his name early in the process, there's only so much room, absent an injury or an off the field situation, that you're going to see him kind of fall back down in the services and the way that they sort out those rankings.
And if they slapped a ton of 4- and 5-star rankings on kids early, that would be a big problem. But I think, and we've seen this, like 247 has only ranked, I think, 9 5-stars so far in the cycle. The hesitancy to slap 5-star rankings on kids early in the process, I would argue, is a good thing, right? If I'm going to put an early 5-star on you, you have to be like a no doubt, hey, man, as long as you stay healthy for your senior year, you have a chance to come in and potentially start at a major program as a freshman type player. Later on in the cycle, we'll see them increase because they have more data points, more chances to evaluate.
Really good point, Bud, and a great perspective from somebody that's in your line of work. Bud, Florida State already has a commitment from one defensive back with a pretty noticeable name, and a second kid that they're involved with is again, a name that some people may recognize. Pat Surtain Jr. has a top 2 and perhaps a final 2 of LSU and FSU, and just give us an idea as to where Florida State stands right now with Surtain.
Speaking with people on both sides, I do think that Florida State feels good about where they are with Surtain. I think LSU feels better about where they are with Pat. Super nice kid, by the way. Like, just people talk about him like he might be the best corner to come out of South Florida since Patrick Peterson, or if you knew him as a recruit, Patrick Johnson, who went to LSU. Obviously, he has a lot of family from Louisiana. His dad played at Southern Miss. I'm going to be honest here and say I don't know where he's going to go. If I had to like pick a gun to my head, I would probably say LSU. There's no silver medal in recruiting, right? But I don't think that Florida State is passing on other targets or making recruiting mistakes in pursuit of Pat, right? Like, Pat's a guy you have to keep pursuing because he's that level of talent. Even if you don't get him, I don't feel like it's going to be a wasted opportunity. I don't think FSU is getting bad info here. I think they're very much in this thing.
I agree. I think they're very much in it and have made a good effort. For me, personally, I think this kid probably ends up wearing purple and gold before he does garnet and gold. But it's a exceptionally talented kid, somebody that will follow as long as there's a story there. And Florida State has very much put themselves in the final group of 2. A new offer out of Louisiana, Bud, an offensive tackle, Cameron Wire.
Yeah, look, Florida State needs tackles in this class. There's no doubt about it. And they have reached out outside of Florida some as well with Cam Wire out of Gonzales, Louisiana. Got to see him at the Nike opening New Orleans camp. Had some good reps. I mean, to me, he didn't profile as like a superstar, but somebody asked me on Twitter, is he a quote-unquote Trickett special? And I don't think he's that either. He's a guy with some length, some athleticism, and some room to add some more good weight, and could potentially turn into a good player. So good for FSU, expanding the board early. There are numbers they have to hit there at the tackle position, and it looks like they are addressing that need early on.
And final little question for you. Josh Moore has narrowed it down to 5 schools. One interesting angle could be here that Nebraska is potentially entertaining taking his brother and putting this more as kind of a combo deal or a package deal, as commonly referred to.
Yeah, Nebraska, if you follow these things, has emerged as the crystal ball favorite. Now, he obviously had a very favorable trip to Nebraska. But the interesting thing here is his brother, because Josh, we talked about a lot, the receiver, he's at IMG, one of the smoothest receivers in the country. There's a lot of Rashad Greene in his game. His brother, Jordan Moore, is not as good, and he's not at IMG. He's back in Texas, and he's committed to Texas A&M. The other schools on his list, right, his top 10, I'm not entirely sure how many of those schools, including FSU, would be willing to take a commit from his brother if his brother wanted to flip from A&M. But Nebraska writers seem very sure that Nebraska would, and I'm judging that based on almost all the Nebraska writers have put a flip pick in for Jordan Moore to flip from Texas A&M to Nebraska. The next obvious question comes, is Josh Moore worth taking his brother? And I think this is nuanced. Jordan Moore is a good player. He's like a national top 400 type kid, maybe top 500, right? I think on the composite, he's number 231. I don't expect that ranking to hold up. In fact, if you look at his history, it's kind of steadily trended downward. He's a good player. It's not like he would, you know, would be like a zero on the roster. So it's not like your typical situation. It's like, hey, should we take this four-star and his slappy teammate?
Right.
Right? But spots are tight in the class, especially at DB, which is what his brother plays. So I don't know if I would. This is something they'd have to think about, and it'll probably be based on how well they're doing recruiting other receivers down the stretch. I know Moore is going to visit FSU again over the summer, and I'm sure they'll have a better perspective there, especially if his brother comes into camp. You know, maybe his brother comes in and they find a role they really like for him.
All right, bud, good little recruiting update there. We'll always do our best to keep people as up to date as possible without, and hopefully we walk a decent tightrope there of letting you know what's going on recruiting at the same time, not drowning you with recruiting information. You know, look, if you have a large platform, sir, and constantly have put out good work, so it's not as though we necessarily have to use this podcast as like a avenue of promotion for material that you've put out recently, but an article that you did publish in the last 24 hours or 48 hours as of time of recording caught my eye. Article that you put out talked a lot about the composition of the ACC as far as the composition of their rosters and how this year's ACC may look very much like perhaps the SEC of recent past, and the fact that this may be a conference that is very defense heavy.
Yeah. So, look, in the past couple of years, obviously Jameis and Deshaun and those types have made the league very high scoring. And in fact, that if you were to put a trend line on points per game, they've steadily gone up since 2008. I mean, big time. It used to be a league where offenses averaged like 21 points a game, and now, if that, and now they're more closer to 30. I went back and I looked at the last 20 drafts, which I feel like is a pretty good little sample set. And I checked it. And Ingram, did you know that over the last 20 years, the ACC has had 70 more defensive players drafted than offense?
I don't know if I knew they had 70. I do remember a conference in the relatively recent past that that just had incredible prospects on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, if you think for a stretch of time as far as the ACC's highest rated draft picks, I mean, I know Matt Ryan went pretty early to the Falcons, but he's really the exception. When you think of most of the ACC's high-level draft picks, for a long time they were coming from defensive ends, they were coming from the defensive side of the ball. And maybe in general recollection, I remember the conference being defensive-tilted, defensive-heavy. I don't know that I necessarily would have guessed it to the tune of 70 draft picks, though.
So I broke it down too because I wanted to make sure it wasn't just like one weird draft. And nine times in the last 20 drafts, the margin for the defense was at least five players. So five more defenders drafted than offensive players. I mean, that's basically like half the time. You know what the highest margin ever until this year was for offensive players over defense? Four. Four. One time, we had four more offensive players picked than defensive players in one draft. This year, the number was plus nine. More than double what we've ever had, right? That's a huge amount of offensive talent leaving. And I looked at it. It's not just numbers. It's where they were. The top five picks that the ACC had, numbers 4, 7, 12, 29, and 41, they were all on offense.
Mm-hmm.
Five of the six top-rated passers in conference play are gone. That's a big deal. And I think further, you know, I looked at this from a couple of perspectives. Number one, the age of the quarterbacks leaving this league, in my opinion, Ingram, it really matters, okay? We probably could have anticipated Watson and Kaya going pro preseason. But I don't think anybody thought that Trubisky or Evans were real contenders to leave early entering the year. Did you?
No. I would have never guessed that. That Mitchell Trubisky would have been in a place to have himself be one of the first five picks taken in the draft.
So we talk about being unprepared as a coaching staff. I think some of those staffs are going to be caught flat-footed. And you know, you think about the possible replacements. I read our Clemson, North Carolina sites, and they both expect significant progression at the quarterback position. Miami might be truly counting on a guy who was basically like a walk-on level player as a recruit or a true freshman who did not enroll early. Virginia Tech, I don't think that they're all that prepared to replace Evans. Check this out, too. I went and I looked back eight seasons, as far back as I could look, right? And I broke it down in terms of seasons by quarter, right? Like top quarter, next quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter in terms of the best. So the best quarter of the seasons over the last 8 years, the top 25% of quarterback seasons over the last 8 years, probably the best way to say this. I found that 2016 accounted for 27% of those, which if you think one out of eight, you would expect them to, you know, a normal distribution would be like 12.5%, right? So disproportionately represented in the best quarter of QBs over the last, you know, seasons of the last 8 years were 2016. So we're not just losing notable names. We're losing literally some of the best quarterback seasons that we've ever had in the league in a really disproportionate number.
Mm-hmm.
At a time in which I don't think these teams are really prepared to replace these players. And I said, here's a Google test. How many ACC quarterbacks can you name?
Really, honestly, not that many. Even as somebody that follows the conference as close as I do.
I mean, I work in the sport, and I could name five.
And I can name four, so.
See? It's really bad. They also lost 13 of the top 20 receivers by yardage. I think the top five running backs by yardage. A number of notable offensive linemen also left. Man, I think these offenses in this league this year are set up to suck. I think we're going to see a reduction in points per game of probably at least a field goal on average. And you think that's not much, but that's potentially a big reduction. I mean, I think we could see, hell, maybe a touchdown lopped off, maybe a 10-15% drop in points per game in conference play. And I think especially when you pair this with the fact that, look, Derwin James is back. I went and pulled up all these early mock drafts, and they're dubious, of course, to do a mock draft this early, but almost every one has eight first-round defensive players from the ACC. Eight!
Mm-hmm.
Like, a quarter of the first round is going to be defenders from the ACC? Wow. You pair that with, I think that the lack of talent and the lack, especially lack of experience coming back on the offensive side of the ball in this league, man, we could be back to the Frank Beamer throwing up his hands, celebrating a 0-0 tie going overtime.
Yes. One of the better images of the last decade in sports. It just reminds me of a time where 10 or 15 years ago, I felt like this was very much the case, you know, like where you had just incredible defenders. Yeah. 10 years ago.
Think about that FSU Virginia Tech, ACC title game.
Mm-hmm. Right. In 2006, where you're scoring off punt returns and everything else. Absolutely.
So, to tie this more to Florida State specifically, since this is an FSU podcast, do we think this is a good thing for FSU this year? Like, does FSU stand to benefit here?
Yeah, I think so. I think you can say there's a couple things here that might pair pretty well with what Florida State does and how they approach, how they approach and how they enter into a season, and also who they have leading them. I'll tell you, if just in my opinion, in Florida State's general roster composition, this kind of fits because it's somewhat similar to what they have. I mean, they themselves have a quarterback who deals a little bit of accuracy issues. They're replacing maybe the program's best running back and a decent amount of questions along the offensive line, and pair that with a really incredible defense. So if you're Florida State, I guess you would either want to have kind of exactly what the rest of the conference has, or you would want to have a complete inverse of it. But I think if you're going to tell me this is a year where defense rules the day and that your offensive production may be down a little bit, I would tell you that that was probably going to be the case in Florida State's point of view in general, just with what their roster looks like. So that's the way that I immediately look at that and try to group it with what we just said. But I think you have a pretty interesting take and maybe even more of a developed idea as far as how this pairs with Florida State's own coaching staff and who they have and the mentality that they have leading them.
Yes. First of all, I think you're exactly right that Florida State is set up to benefit from this. From that perspective, because their style probably matches the rest of the league. I think that almost every team in the league is going to struggle to sustain like long grinding drives, right? You just have too many inexperienced and problematic issues on the offense in this conference on the whole compared to really top level defensive players. So going on these 8, 10, 12 play drives, I think is going to be very tough. The teams that most effectively generate explosive plays are going to most benefit from this. And guess who I think is going to have a good chance to generate explosive plays? Florida State. You may talk about the consistency at the offensive line position, obviously, the quarterback position with the accuracy issues, the receivers with the inexperience and the route running issues, all valid. But we can also note that they do a pretty good job of generating explosive plays. Explosive plays are going to be ever so valuable in this league this year with the inability for teams to sustain drives, as I anticipate. Further, I think there's an element to Jimbo Fisher's game management in this that is highlighted, right? We've pointed out how Jimbo does a great job at so many things. I mean, he's a really good coach, obviously. He is a tremendous recruiter, which is the most important part of college football coaching. You've got to get players. But game management-wise, he does struggle with overly conservative decisions that decrease his team's win probability. Provably so. This is not just speculation or opinion. You can look at win probability metrics, and when he kicks these field goals or when he punts, it does decrease FSU's chances of winning, regardless of make or miss, because you have to evaluate pre-outcome. However, Jimbo's decisions to do this are a lot more detrimental in a high-scoring environment. And the reason is this. if the game is going to be played in like the 40s or 50s, or hell, maybe the 30s, as some of these might this year for in the ACC, a field goal isn't quite as bad as if the game is going to be played in the upper 50s or the 60s or the low 70s, right? Which were most of the ACC games last year. I mean, teams were averaging almost 29 points a game. So if Jimbo kicks a field goal or decides to do a foolish punt, it's still foolish, but it's less foolish, right? If, in fact, we're playing in a lower point environment. It's kind of like bunting in baseball. In a game, you know, where it's going to be like 3-2 with two aces on the mound, it's less detrimental to your chance of winning as if you're playing Coors Field with two rookies pitching and you know you're going to need probably a 10 spot on the board. So while I feel like Jimbo does actually do a decent job sometimes coaching in these shootout type games, we've talked about this, especially like North Carolina last year, he doesn't always seem to be able to anticipate the need to score a lot of points. Kicking those field goals against North Carolina last year, not setting up to go for it on fourth down as is optimal. I think this is going to be maybe good for him. This is a guy who was Nick Saban's offensive coordinator. He is very comfortable coaching in these low-scoring games. I think this sets up to benefit FSU.
I think it's a good idea just to have in the back of your head as we enter into summer and obviously a lot of time to think and a lot of different ideas that could be kicked around. But I think that's a great idea, Bud. Well said. Certainly would point people in the direction of the article that we referenced. I know that's something, again, that you've put out here in the last 24, 48 hours. It's titled, Why ACC Football Will Look More Like the SEC in 2017. And I would encourage anybody to take a look at it if you haven't already consumed it.
We got anything else?
I don't think we do, per se. I mean, I think this was just a good recap. You feel the need to talk about that picture of Jim McElwain at all, Bud?
Yeah, we could talk about that real quick. Okay. God, there are so many things here. Number one, do you think it's him? Do you think he's naked, laying on, maybe humping a shark? Yeah,
I have thought at no time there was any chance this was him at all until he gave that response. I completely dismissed it. I thought, hey, look, it's a picture. Not necessarily from a million miles away, but it's not exactly a close up either. It's from a little bit of a strange angle. You know, we don't all lay on top of sharks and have pictures taken of us from the second level of a ship. And also, more importantly, where it came from an animal rights activist in the UK. I'm you know, look, we live in a time where you can send anybody anything, but I'm just not sure how, if it was legitimately Jim McElwain, how it made its way to this particular person. Now, look, email's a wonderful thing. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it would be curious. I would really want to know the steps that this particular picture took, and how it made its way to light. Having said that, I didn't think it was him, but his answer was so, I mean, maybe that's just the way he thought was appropriate to address this, but I would think from a PR perspective, there's 100 different ways to do this that might be a little bit more effective, and just from my own personal opinion, I just thought that you know, with as defensive as he is and the way he answered that question, maybe I really do need to entertain the idea that this might, in fact, that this theoretically could be him anyway.
I don't think it's him, but man, the denial in the press conference that he issued, just the complete lack of the ability to laugh about this, you know, and like, he's like, I don't know who it is, but it's definitely not me.
Who knows what becomes a story nowadays? Well, it's not a ridiculous story, Coach. That happens to look exactly like your ass. No, this is not a media fabrication or anything.
And by your ass, you mean like you, not like specifically.
Like I've seen that ass, Jim, and that's what it looks like. So. Yes, that man, is like, that is what
I
mean.
If it's not you, don't you laugh about it and be like, I don't know who that is, yeah. But it's not me. I'm serious, guys.
I think you laugh about it. I think off the record you say, oh, you know, in college I might have woken up next to a whale once or twice, but no, I've never jumped on a shark. Ha, ha, ha.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
you just say, say, look, guys, not me. It's ridiculous. I know you guys are wildly awkward and uncomfortable asking me this question, but man, damn if that isn't a strange coincidence and a nice little tidbit for the off season. But it's hilarious, and a lot of other people have talked about this. The layers of onion in this hilarity are fantastic. It is, it's mind blowing to me that the University of Florida had to at first issue a denial, kind of through back channels. Then they had to go to him and get a comment from him. And then he had to directly address the issue on video. So the fact that this story keeps evolving is incredible. Also, let me see how I can say this. As somebody that has worked in the media, somebody that's worked in radio and has been in those type of settings, like, That question didn't blindside him. He knew that was coming. Either he had a talk with his SID or his handler. And I'm just surprised in general that that was the response that they formulated and decided that would be the way to address that issue. But as others have pointed out, I know Corey Clark wrote a column on it. I mean, the fact that Florida's official website decided to write a story that their coach did not indeed, commit some deed, perhaps mixed with bestiality and necrophilia, is incredible and mind blowing. So, I don't know how much more there is of this story. I don't know where it goes. I know it's something that we'll see for years. It will be interesting to see how much ESPN edits the signs that appear at game day. You have to think that is a mainstay in the future. But man, what an absolute hilarious thing! And honestly, I don't know that I've had I can't remember a singular source be a more consistent and constant source of laughs from the college football world over the past 5 days. I really can't remember anything over the past 10 years to pair with how much fun and how many laughs I've had a particular subject over the past 5 days.
Oh, it's been some of these Photoshops. Like, I don't know who made the one of him in the aquarium. Yes. Looking up with the erection.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That
oh,
is.
My God.
That is absolutely hilarious, and then so much opportunity. You know, he has his own unique style, and some of the way that he's responded to questions in the past, and the what you can do with media and pair that is hilarious. And yeah, there's a lot of great stuff out there on it. And I also, Bud, I wonder if I'm hesitant to be real critical of him, because I don't know that there's a great way that you can handle the media story that is, hey, there happens to be a picture of a guy jumping on a shark who looks exactly like your head coach. But I don't think Florida necessarily did themselves any favor here with the way they handled this. This was I feel like a relatively small story. This first tweet was sent out either last Thursday or Friday, and it had a little bit of play Friday night, but then all of a sudden, Monday morning, Florida itself started addressing this issue, maybe a little bit earlier than it had to, and it seemed to kind of breathe life into the story even more. So I'm curious as to how they'll handle this from a PR standpoint moving forward, but the fact that you've had to have two or three different denials that Florida's head coach did not, in fact, take his clothes off and jump on a shark is, again, something that I'll remember and laugh at for a long, long time.
Indeed. I think we're probably done now. We got anything else?
I think that'll be a good little way to finish this podcast. So, something that hopefully we'll be able to laugh at one or two more times in the future. Bud, great to have you back and be able to put together a podcast again. I want to thank our sponsors as always. Want to thank all of our listeners and the people that have provided us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Just want to point out that iTunes is not the only subscriptions or not the only service that you can rate us. I looked at Stitcher a couple days ago, and we have some great reviews on there from the existing ones. But if that's the platform that you use, if you could take 2 or 3 minutes to give us a rating, that would be fantastic as well. Everything matters. I can promise you everything is very much appreciated. And just want to thank our audience for the support that they've given us over the years. And Bud, with that, I think that'll probably draw an end to this episode of the Nullcast. Como a pluma que o vento vai levando pelo ar. Voa tão leve, mas tem a vida breve. Precisa que haja vento sem parar. A felicidade do pobre parece a grande ilusão do carnaval. A gente trabalha.